Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is Rahul calling in from Berkeley, California, and I'm going to be hosting this week's weekly Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you all so much for joining us. And today, our very special guest is none other than Professor Lorenzo Fioramonte, who really embodies this theme of understanding how to value and count things that can't be counted. We're going to transition things over to our host, our moderator, in the next few moments, and that's the amazing Preeta Bansal, and she's going to engage in dialogue with Lorenzo. And then at the top of the hour, we're going to roll into a Q&A and sharing, where we invite all of the questions and reflections from folks who've dialed into the call. Again, today's theme is value that can't be counted, and Lorenzo is quite an expert on this as a professor of political economy in South Africa and the author of a number of well-regarded books. He's quite an expert. We've got Preeta, who actually has interacted with Lorenzo in the past as our moderator today, and Preeta, of course, has had a long history of high positions in government and has been part of a number of panels on this, including the most recent Bretton Woods. So I thought maybe we could start off by just turning things over to Preeta for a couple of thoughts and an introduction to the topic.
Yeah, well, great. Thank you, Rahul. Really excited to be in conversation with Lorenzo. So I'll just give a really brief introduction. I'm not going to repeat his extensive bio. Lorenzo is a professor of political economy in South Africa, where he directs the Center for the Study of Governance Innovation. His research interests are very broad-ranging. They range from alternative economic paradigms to the governance of the commons, to global political innovations, and to new forms of supranational regionalism. He has a number of very prestigious chairs. He's involved with the European Union. He does a lot of work around kind of well-being economics. And as Rahul mentioned, he's written a number of very well-regarded books, the most recent of which is How Numbers Rule the World. So as we get started, I thought maybe, Lorenzo, you could just start by describing a little bit about your view of numbers and especially GDP, and you know, maybe outline for us a little bit your critique of GDP and what led you to focus on that particular issue.
Thank you, Priya. Okay, so well, good evening or good morning in that case, wherever you are, everybody. I got interested in studying numbers. Well, first of all, because I happen to be an economist, and economists are passionate about numbers, and also because I've realized that the way in which we govern our societies, or the way in which we run our companies, the way in which we're, you know, more and more even just simply, you know, engage with our communities and even, you know, organize our family life is organized around ways of measuring what we do, right? Measurement is not just a number. Every time we measure, it's basically a way of organizing order, creating order and to increase, you know, like the defining goals and targets and creating conditions to achieve those targets. So measurement is a very political process, and what happens is that I've realized more and more that the way in which we measure reality affects the way in which we understand it, and affects our behavior, affects our patterns of interaction, and therefore, if we want to change the world, if we want to reorganize ourselves, we may very well want to start from rethinking the numbers that we have given ourselves in order to organize reality and dealing with it. So it's a very political way of looking at numbers and realizing that they're the ultimate tools for constructing our governance systems. So in my specific case, you know, what I've been writing a lot about is how GDP, the gross domestic product, has become the fundamental ordering principle of all our economies around the world. Whether you're a communist, whether you're a socialist, whether you're a heads about it capitalist, all you do these days is increasing GDP as the ultimate evidence of success. So politicians have stopped, you know, being involved in political negotiations and discussions. Our democracy has been devoid of the capacity to really choose, because ultimately all we have to do is one thing, which is increasing the economic growth of our economies. And this is dictated by GDP, how GDP is measured. GDP is not a neutral measure of success. It is a measure that, you know, has specific characteristics and has specific looks at certain things, doesn't look at other things. And in this regard, it makes us blind towards different types of value and makes us overly obsessed with other types of value. You still don't know.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying, so what does it push us to ignore? In terms of values, and when you say that, you know, economic growth, it pushes us towards valuing economic growth, are you saying that we shouldn't be as focused on economic growth?
Look, okay, so I can give you more details. Okay, so you tell me what level of detail you want me to get into. But, you know, one way, so if we understand numbers and statistics as ways of ruling society, right, you know, as I usually, you know, I have one, you know, very, you know, like a dear quote that I use all the time, you know, kind of an elevator pitch, if you will. If you think about a ruler, what is a ruler in English? A ruler is somebody that governs. But in English, it's also a measurement tool, right? So ruling and measuring are even semantically very close to one another, because in order for you to decide what to do and what is the ultimate objective of our social life or our political life, you have to be able to measure that. So measuring is never neutral. Measuring makes us, able to see certain things and creates the conditions so that we can achieve those things. So whatever we measure affects what we do. Now, the problem with GDP is that GDP is a very myopic way of measuring economic performance. GDP only measures transactions and measures only formal transactions, which all, you know, evidently generates paradoxes, right? So if I look after my kids, instead of hiring a babysitter, that doesn't increase GDP. But if I leave and leave my kids with somebody else and I pay the person, that increases GDP. It's the same function, it's the same performance, but in one case, it doesn't count as generating value. In one other case, it does. If I grow my own food and eat what I'm actually growing in my garden, it doesn't count as actually as a sign of a developed society. But if I go out and buy a Big Mac at McDonald's, it does. So whatever we need to do, you know, so if we want to increase GDP, we have to increase our transactions and eliminate as much as possible non-transaction systems of interaction. Also, you know, if you think about how this has generated evident paradoxes, you know, like if you divorce, GDP grows. If there is a catastrophe or a natural disaster and you have to rebuild your house, you know, the GDP grows. If actually your house is pretty poorly built and it breaks every 5 years and you have to fix it every time it breaks, it's an advantage. It's a good thing for the economy because GDP grows. So GDP doesn't distinguish between transactions that really add value and transactions that take value away. For GDP, every time money moves, it's a good thing for the economy. Now you may say, doesn't really matter in the end. It does, because then that makes our policies favor things that can increase GDP, because that's what policies are supposed to achieve. And therefore, you have something known as, you know, planned obsolescence when you buy things. We know that things break all the time. One reason why this happens is that our economic systems are made to generate transactions, and therefore things have to break all the time. We shouldn't be able to fix them. We have to throw them away and buy new things in order for the economy to keep generating value. Family breakdowns can add to GDP, and we see more and more of this happening in society. We have less and less time for leisure because leisure doesn't add to GDP, although it generates a lot of value which adds to well-being and development. But leisure is not good for GDP, so what we have to do, ideally, is to go to work, hire somebody to look after the kids, and then every time that we move, we have to spend money. So the ideal society for GDP is a society in which we don't cook our own food, we don't look after ourselves, we are always sick because then we need a doctor and the doctor has to be paid, and so on and so forth. So we have this picture of the ideal GDP man is an obese man driving his car, stuck in a traffic jam, eating a hamburger and holding onto the phone while he talks to his lawyer, who's actually taking care of his divorce. And while he does that, he's about to have a car accident and a heart attack. All these things are good things for GDP, and we see our societies having become more and more similar to the GDP type of man, because the policies designed to increase GDP make us unable and, you know, like to perform activities which are not transactional in this regard, and, you know, totally neglect what really matters. And this also extends, if you will, I mean, speaking during the climate change negotiations in Paris, the same applies to how we deal with nature in our economic systems, right? So nature has got no value for GDP. Trees that we grow, every time we grow a tree, the GDP doesn't take that into account as increasing the economic value of our society. But when we chop them, it does. It increases GDP. When we sell them off, it increases GDP. When there's a fire, GDP goes up. But if a forest keeps operating naturally and beautifully, GDP doesn't take notice of that. So even in our relationship with the environment, what GDP does is that it puts priority on exploiting the environment, because nurturing the environment and creating an environment which has a strong impact on our well-being is not good for the type of economic measurements we have chosen. And this is extremely dangerous. It's driving us into madness.
That's fascinating. So it's interesting because the GDP as a measure and kind of arose relatively recently, I think in the 1930s, and almost accidentally, as I understand it, in terms of having the salience it did. Can you describe a little bit about that? And I'm just kind of curious, by putting so much emphasis on GDP as having distorted our policies, the fact that it's relatively recent in the 30s as opposed to kind of with the turn of the rise of high finance or capitalism or big banks in the kind of turn of the century, 20th century, I mean, I wonder what your views are on those other possible contributors to the over-commercialization or the over-financial focus of our lives.
Yes, GDP was actually, technically speaking, it was introduced in 1934. At that time, it wasn't even called GDP, it was called something different. But it was introduced to the U.S. Congress in 1934. And one of the guys that actually developed GDP wasn't just one person's product, but the main architect of GDP, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Simon Kuznets, himself had many doubts about how this measurement could affect policies. He did it because at that time, if you remember, there was the Great Depression. You know, government wanted to know how to put people back to work, and they didn't really have any way of measuring whether the economy was responding positively or negatively to their policies. So this guy went out there and said, "What about collecting a lot of data about what companies do?" And started doing that massively with a lot of work, going out there and filling in forms and getting a sense of how many transactions were happening in society. And and interestingly, he recognized that he had to set boundaries, right? So he himself had to decide which companies to consider as part of the economy, which companies not to consider as part of the economy. He had to say, for instance, households, although they generate a lot of value, I'm going to decide, based on my own experience, that they're not going to count. But he said maybe at some stage we should consider counting them as part of the economy, because there's no reason why a firm is considered in GDP and a family isn't. So, and he had many interesting questions about GDP, but he was under pressure. He had to develop this for the Great Depression. Then actually what happened is that it turned out to be pretty useful in gauging how much production was going on. That when the Second World War happened, President Roosevelt wanted Kuznets to be using GDP to basically plan the extent to which the Americans could get involved in the war. So if you think about it, it's a very useful tool when you want to plan a war, because it can tell you the extent to which, for instance, your firms are able to produce bombs and bullets and tanks and airplanes and so on and so forth. So in terms of, it's a very, if you will, material, grossly inefficient way of measuring holistic economic performance, but it's a good one when it comes to mere industrial output, and that's something you want to know when you're about to wage a war. Interestingly, Kuznets himself thought that GDP would be abandoned once the war ended, but of course, the Americans found it extremely useful to win the war, and they said, why should we abandon that way of measuring the economy now when it turned out to be one of our major assets during the Second World War? Among economic historians, the invention of GDP is usually referred to as the Manhattan Project of economics, because if you think about it, it was a very important planning tool for the war, and it was probably as important as the nuclear bomb for America to win the war and then expand internationally after the end of the war. Now, you're right. You know, problems didn't start with GDP. We've had problems around the world forever, and the Industrial Revolution generated a lot of negative environmental and social impacts long before GDP was invented. But GDP perfected that. It's a bit like the invention of the compass, if you think about it. You know, it's not that the compass started navigation. People were navigating the oceans before, looking at the stars, but then the compass made it possible to kind of expand that way of reasoning to the four corners of the world. And all of a sudden, everybody used the compass perfectly to do exactly the same, but now there was a tool that could be used to standardize that approach. GDP did exactly the same. It kind of standardized this heavily industrial focus, output-based focus on development and economic performance, which, as I said, is extremely reductive. It's extremely confusing, and even more so at the time when we're dealing with social imbalances, rampant inequality, climate change, environmental destruction, a lot of dissatisfaction across the world. This kind of tool is becoming more and more myopic, more and more misleading in today's world, even more than it was 81 years ago.
Wow, okay, that's fascinating. So there's been, since especially in the last 20 years, there's been kind of the rise of a lot of alternative indices for well-being. There's, I think, Amartya Sen was focused on the Human Development Index. There's been a number of indices for global well-being. There's obviously the Bhutan Gross National Happiness Index. I think I've seen some stuff about how on the Global Well-Being Index, you actually see countries where GDP rises also showing to some degree a corresponding increase in their kind of well-being up to a point. But then thereafter, as GDP goes up, well-being actually starts going down. So I wonder what you think of some of these alternative indices, which ones you think potentially support as alternative indices, and kind of how you think the measurement can actually, how do you measure things which can't be valued? How does that happen?
Okay, so I want to repeat once again that measuring is really about redefining politics. Okay, so just for the people who are listening, I don't want them to get kind of bored with details about statistics. In the end, what we're talking about is ways of redefining our political goals, and in that process, we stand a better chance, in my view, to regain control of our democracies. Now, you're right, since at least the 1980s, well, even earlier, if you will, but I mean, since the 1980s, we've been having a lot of, the critique of GDP has kind of grown, mostly among experts, and alternative indicators were developed, right? And you mentioned the Human Development Index, developed by the NDP through the advice of Amartya Sen. There have been others. In the 1980s, the Gender and Progress Indicator was invented by Herman Daly, former chief economist at the World Bank and professor at the University of Maryland, one of the scholars that has contributed the most to the critique of GDP. There has been the case of, more recent, of course, the case of Bhutan. They only started measuring gross national happiness, although it was introduced in 1972 as a concept. They only started measuring it in 2008. And nowadays, I mean, honestly, you can read a lot of stuff that I work on. There is a long list of alternative indicators that are being developed. Now, the issue is, what do we mean by well-being, and how do we measure well-being, right? And for instance, the research we have done on simply on using the Gender and Progress Indicator. The Gender and Progress Indicator does something very simple. It takes GDP, and it does what GDP doesn't do, right? It distinguishes between good and bad transactions, right? So it takes GDP, and then it starts deducting how, you know, like traffic jams. Traffic jams cannot, what is the cost of traffic jams, and sees that as a negative. So it takes it, it deducts it from GDP. It deducts negative transactions. It detects deducts the cost of commuting. It attacks, you know, like the spread of diseases, all things that, in a sense, would add to GDP, but the GPI sees them as taking well-being away from the people. So, so what, if you will, the GPI, the Genuine Progress Indicator, is a bit like GDP with common sense, right? If you do that and you apply that across the world, we see an interesting trajectory. Since the end of the Second World War, more or less, more GDP gave us a bit of an increase in overall progress up until the 1970s, up until Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan took over, respectively, the United Kingdom and the U.S. After that, GDP started growing even more, but mostly it was because of the negative transactions. So, and interestingly, since 1977, incidentally, the year in which I was born, our progress starts going down. So this is, in a sense, what you were trying to say earlier, that there was a time in which, because of certain policies, because of redistribution mechanisms, because of, you know, coming out of the war and rebuilding Europe and so on and so forth, the growth of GDP was more or less associated with growth in real progress. But up until the late 70s, growth in GDP turned into something extremely negative, and all of a sudden, the negative parts of GDP outweighed the positive parts. And the curve of the progress started going down. So this is an interesting one. If you use another indicator, which is being introduced by the World Bank in the 1990s, and it's simply what it does something similar to the Genuine Progress Indicator, but focuses mostly on environmental destruction. Okay, so it takes environmental destruction, measures what it may cost to fix certain outcomes of GDP, and takes that out of GDP. And then we see that since the 80s, again, the GDP hasn't, you know, our economic growth globally hasn't grown at all. It's only grown because we have decided not to look at the costs generated by those industrial transactions that were pushing up the economy but also creating a lot of costs for society. The same applies to China and India these days, two countries that we often describe as successful in economic development, but actually this is just because GDP doesn't show the costs of the social and environmental destruction that came with that model of growth. And when you start measuring that, both China and India go negative, and so does the rest of Africa. So in a sense, what I'm trying to say is that there may be a level or a way of fusing GDP only in certain sectors and cleaning it of the negative parts, and that may still be associated with some levels of well-being. But the current model we have shows that GDP growth, unless it's really controlled and tamed and changed by strong corrective policies by government, leads to less well-being, more environmental destruction, and more inequality. So this is the trend we see around the world. At the same time, we also know, conceptually, this is something that economists call the Easterlin paradox. We know very well that our level of satisfaction cannot keep up with the consumption of goods and services, right? We are, this is something that, you know, everybody would understand, we are continuously assessing our level of satisfaction, you know, in comparison with what people around us have. So the more we grow in consumption and services, the more our expectations grow as well. So, and we get into this hedonic treadmill, if you will, whereby more consumption leads to more wants, and more wants lead to more consumption. And therefore, having more and more stuff doesn't make us happier, because we live in a society in which more and more stuff is demanded and requested in order to fit in society, and therefore you increase your demands, and you go with your peers. So in a sense, GDP hasn't even managed to make us, if you will, happy and satisfied by giving us a continuous flow of goods and services, because at the end of the day, those goods and services are always relative to what people around us have. The more we all have, the more we'll want to compare ourselves to them, and so on and so forth. So in a sense, you know, like in both cases, conceptually and measurement-wise, GDP has failed us.
Well, so what is the post, I know a lot of your work has been not just on the critique of GDP, but the more affirmative work of kind of conceiving alternative social organizations. And I wonder if you could describe kind of what a post-GDP world looks like for you, and some examples, some concrete examples where, you know, maybe differing measuring systems have led to different outcomes.
Yes. As I said at the beginning, my interest in GDP was really motivated by what I thought was a desperately need we had of performing the way most societies organize. And somehow, you know, as an economist that works a lot on with institutions, I thought that if we were to change the way in which my assumption, if you will, my conviction is that if we are to change the way in which we measure success, this will have a cascade on society whereby our targets will change, our priorities will change, our values will be affected, the way in which we see the reality. It's a bit like seeing through the matrix. When you recognize the matrix, all of a sudden you see other things and you change in, as a result. Now, changing GDP for me stands a great, by changing GDP, we stand a great chance of rethinking the way in which we have organized society and dealing, in, if you will, in one go with all the bad things we're seeing today. The threat posed by environmental destruction, the social disruption and imbalance created by this model of organization, whether it's family breakdowns, whether it's drug abuse, whether it's, you know, like simple, you know, growth of depression and stress-related diseases and so on and so forth, and also, you know, like the breakdown of our community ties. So look at what as I said, GDP makes us believe. GDP is like wearing GDP like any other performance tool, like any other number. It's like wearing a set of glasses. When you wear the GDP glasses, you only see certain things. You don't see other things as valuable, right? So GDP makes us focus on economies of scale. GDP gives us an idea that a developed society is a society in which there are large corporations, you know, communities, families, small businesses really don't matter. GDP makes us believe that nature doesn't really matter. All you have to do is appropriate it and exploit it in order to make it valuable. GDP, as I said, makes us believe that, you know, like social connections don't matter. What you have to do is to be competitive, you have to be selfish, and you have to exploit. Ideally, I mean, in terms of GDP, even love doesn't matter. You know, like actually to increase GDP, we should all, you know, prostitute ourselves. That would be ideal, right? Because actually exchanging love with somebody you care about doesn't increase GDP. But if you pay somebody to have sex or you pay somebody to be your companion, then that actually increases GDP. So in a sense, GDP, if GDP could run us to the extreme, it would want money to change hands in everything we do. You wouldn't want generosity. You wouldn't want reciprocity to lead anything. So everything has to have a price in order for GDP to be fully satisfied. So if you turn that on its head, what does the post-GDP economy look like? Well, if you start changing that, all of a sudden, that's what I'm advocating, is that all the things that are neglected by GDP become the drivers of the post-GDP economy. So the post-GDP economy, or you can call it the well-being-based economy, becomes an economy which is driven by strong social ties, becomes an economy in which nature is a driver of prosperity, in which nature is at the core of our idea of development, in which nature has to be preserved, encouraged to improve, and we need to reconnect with in order for us to be developed. It becomes a society in which generosity and reciprocity, more than money transactions, indicates a higher level of development. It becomes a society in which communities and families are more important than corporations because they produce well-being more than corporations, and they actually, you know, have fewer negative externalities when as we know, the negative externalities of many corporations outweigh the benefits and the gains of their profits. So, it becomes an economy in which fossil fuels disappear because fossil fuels make no sense from a well-being perspective because, as I said, the costs that they generate by orders of magnitude outweigh the benefits in terms of profits, or even in terms of taxes. It becomes a society in which, if you will, all the things that we associate with civil society, right, the third sector, the nonprofit, which in a GDP language has become this residual, marginal, do-gooders, but not really important bunch of guys, becomes actually the opposite. It becomes the real driver of prosperity. So a society, a country that has a strong civil society, will be seen in a post-GDP world as the most as a more developed country, as a country that has a higher level of development, as a higher level of prosperity and well-being. And ideally, even our economic rules and policies should actually encourage that. It's a society which is driven by small family businesses, because the more a business is small, the more it is in touch with the needs and is capable of adapting to the changing demands and generating less waste and generating fewer negative externalities. If you think about numbers as a way of governing things at a distance, right? You were saying at the beginning you see this proliferation of performance management tools all over. But in a sense, they're a response to the fact that we need to run big organizations without having clear first-hand knowledge of what's going on, right? So we use numbers in order to get a proxy of what is happening and whether we are achieving certain results. Interestingly, in a post-GDP world, if we scale the system down to levels in which we are in control and we can contribute to directly, we can also let go of a lot of numbers, because our direct, if you will, spiritual, personal experience will count much more than this, the system of parameters and indicators that are have been introduced only because we have distanced ourselves from the goals of our actions to a point in which we don't know what we're doing anymore. We need to be guided by a set of indicators. The more we reconnect ourselves with the objectives of our actions, whether it's in companies, whether it's in universities, whether it's in governments, the more we localize the system of governance to a level in which we are in close touch with our actions, the less we need these numbers.
That's great. It sounds like you're describing in some ways, and I know you're talking about something slightly different, so I'd love for you to tease this out in you. It sounds like you're describing a little bit the E.F. Schumacher small is beautiful vision of kind of localized, less impersonalized, complex systems. And I know you're talking about something slightly different, so I'd love to hear a little bit about the distinction of what
well,
you're
envisioning. Well, I think I am. I'm a big fan of E.F. Schumacher. I really think he was the greatest, at least one of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century. And I have huge respect for his work and for his what he left us with. What my work is, what I'm describing is very much the idea of small is beautiful, but small is beautiful because it's connected, not just because it's small. So I think what Schumacher couldn't see because he died too early, he didn't have the kind of first-hand experience we have nowadays with the technological revolution, for instance. And what technologies allow us to create a system of scale for everything we do, whether it's, as I said, a company, whether it's a business, whether it's a government, whether it's a university, whether it's an NGO, whatever you want, a system of scale which puts us in touch with our own actions and at the same time doesn't disconnect us for the greater scheme of things. Nowadays, technologies allow us to be able to produce and consume at the local level while being part of a global network of producers and consumers. Or as I usually say, this is becoming more and more common as a term, as presumers, right? Producers and consumers are no longer divided, or we can overcome that traditional divide. Those technologies were not available back in the 70s when Schumacher wrote. And now they're becoming more and more common. You see the sharing economy prospering around the world. Now we're bypassing hotels with Airbnb. We can just put people together and connect them, and you can actually stay at somebody's house for much less money and a greater level of well-being, if you will, right? So I'm just saying these are just examples of technological advancements that allow us to bypass that obsession with scale that always vertical. In the history of at least of capitalism, but also of communism and socialism, scale was vertical, right? So in order to grow, certain things had to move from small to bigger on a vertical level, and then you needed systems in order to manage that vertical structure. Nowadays, we can achieve, and this was indispensable in order to generate enough things for the people who needed them, right? But now, technologies allow us to be able to stay small and connect and still generate a system which is in sync and can generate that level of outputs and services that we need, but without needing to build an infrastructure which is vertical, like connecting small. It's a bit like nodes in a network. It's a bit like cells in a body. So what we're able to do is something that Schumacher, in a sense, probably only remotely thought of, you know, like the possibility of connecting the small, not for the sake of staying small, but connecting the small because it's the most responsible and adaptable level of scale, and at the same time creating a system of scaling laterally or scaling across, which allows the small to be as efficient as the big, but without all the negative impacts of the big. Interestingly, Gandhi had already envisioned a system like this. He thought the village, the ideal unit of governance, was a village in which everybody participated in the running of the public good. And at the same time, villages were able to communicate with one another as part of a bigger organism. That was the ideal system of governance for Gandhi. So this idea has been around for some time. And now, for the first time in history, we have we are at a crossroads. We have a convergence of technologies, values, critiques, and needs that together gives an opportunity to really create what you can call the commons-based economy and make it as efficient, actually more efficient, than the conventional GDP economy.
You and I have spoken a little bit in the past, or recently, about kind of Germany and the ways in which they have, as an example of kind of the smart grid and a way of organizing that has achieved some of these values, as well as some of their kind of local currencies and the network of local currencies that have implemented some of this. And I'm wondering, could you maybe just spend a minute and describe some of those?
Yes. And I mean, far from me to argue that Germany is the best example. It's just that I happen to live in Germany. I'm married to a German, and I studied Germany because I speak the language and I could do that. And I found a lot of interesting things happening in that country. And also, it's a good country in the sense that it's a conventional economy. It's a member of the G7. It's not Bhutan. It's not a radically different country. It's a normal country in which certain things are happening because people want them to happen. Interestingly, for instance, in Germany is a country with a long history of hierarchy and a long history of despotism and a long history of fascism and a long history of vertical systems of control, right? And yet what we've seen in the past few years is the growth of autonomous producers of energy, for instance. So while we still would talk about shale gas or fracking and nuclear and all that stuff, in Germany 40% of the energy on a good day is produced by non-commercial producers. It's produced by renewable, by families, buildings, households, small businesses, people that put their PV panels on the roof or wind turbines or geothermal systems in their gardens and are connected through a smart grid, through a grid that allows them to do that. 40%. This is just the beginning. In the future, if we're all connecting, the whole energy system could be run by people. And all we need is a government which allows the grid to be a common, to be shared by all the users. So government has to make sure that thing stays within, stays neutral, that nobody can appropriate the grid, because otherwise you have a system in which somebody could become a monopolist, right, and using the grid in order to force its own interests. And business, what does business do in this regard? Instead of producing energy that then comes to us as users or consumers, the business becomes a facilitator of the exchange. So now you have a proliferation of new business models in which small companies, you pay small companies to allow you to improve your capacity to connect with the grid and reduce your costs, or to make your energy inputs into the grid as efficient as possible. So you are the producer and the consumer, and the business only becomes the facilitator. This means this is the end of General Electric. This is the end of the big utilities. This is the end of it. We are moving towards a system, if we are serious about it, in which this kind of non-GDP, lateral organization systems, in which we produce and consume our own energy without necessarily a transaction that involved in that process, can become the mainstream. Germany also happens to be, as I've said to you in the past, one way of facilitating this commons-based economy, this post-GDP economy, is also to rethink what money is for. And one way of doing that is not by necessarily eliminating money, but simply creating money that has a different purpose. So instead of creating debt fiat-based money, which is the money we have, which then requires growth. Growth in GDP becomes indispensable because you need to pay the debt back. And if growth doesn't happen, you don't have enough money to pay the debt of the money that you were given in the first place. Creating debt-free money, which is usually known as local currencies or alternative currencies or complementary currencies. Most of these currencies are debt-free, and they're even locally based, which means that money has to circulate within a specific geographical extent. So this makes us also more responsible towards the local economy, more interested in the local impacts of what we do. So instead of speculating against in the global level, we are more in touch with the needs and the dynamics of our local economy. In Germany, there is the largest network of local currencies in the world, and most of these are locally based, often at the level of a small village or a county, but yet they are connected with one another in a regional network that covers more than 50% of the country. So in a sense, it's a potential challenge to a national currency. And there is no reason to believe that if these local currencies were to connect across borders, they could also become a serious and positive challenge to the euro or to the dollar in the U.S. and so on and so forth. So there is a potential for our technologies to be used in a way to create money which responds to the needs of a post-GDP economy rather than relying on the type of money that actually created and reinforced the GDP economy.
Fascinating. I often like to say that technology has the potential to transform us not into a global village, but a globe of villages. And that's kind of, it sounds like what you're describing, which is kind of a lot of local economies, but connected. That's really exciting.
Speaking of connection, Preetha, before you ask your next question, I just wanted to remind folks that if they'd like to ask a question, they can press *6 to get in the queue, and they'll be notified when they're ready to ask that question. But go ahead, Preetha. This is fascinating.
Yeah, awesome. Well, so Lorenzo, I mean, you've been writing and thinking some of the most interesting thoughts, ideas. You've been on the cusp of the convergence of a lot of different alternative thinking. And, you're kind of pushing against the tide, obviously. The question I ask is kind of, how do you keep up your own personal resilience in the face of very resilient dominant systems that you're trying to lay bare in part? What practices allow you to kind of stay in the game with the same amount of passion and vigor to keep, pushing forward?
Well, it's a deep recognition that the system we have inherited is broken, and that at some point somebody has to do something to change this state of affairs. It's also the fact that I'm a father and my husband, so I have a beautiful family. I believe that we all have a responsibility to change as much as we can in order to build a future which is better than the present in which we live. And I have to say that it is true, although people like me are swimming against the tide. I write for newspapers, and my articles are usually the only one speaking against the current, and the rest of the newspaper is more conventional wisdom. And every time I'm in a public debate, I tend to be seen as the doomsayer or the naysayer, and everybody else is happy with things the way they are. But there are so many people out there as well that recognize that things are not good at all, that start connecting the dots and are looking for answers and potential visions and narratives. And that gives me a lot of energy every time I get to know people like you guys, the movements around the world that are trying to make a difference one way or another. I'm reminded we're not alone. And maybe we're not even a minority. We're just not vocal or loud enough, or maybe we're just getting more and more organized as we speak, and our power, our capacity to change things is just increasing every time that we create these connections like this call today. And what happened in the past with me as well, for the past few years, I've come across incredible people, and starting to connect people, incredible people with incredible people, you multiply the impact. You're generating an exponential growth of change makers. And in a sense, I think this is what keeps me going, interest in what I'm doing, the realization that business as usual is not acceptable, and the fact that deep down I know that we're doing the right thing, and maybe looking back one day, we're going to see this as a pivotal moment in which things were coming, you know, like we're about to change. And I believe that, you know, the people behind us, the generations like, you know, like the Martin Luther Kings, the civil rights movements, the apartheid movements of the past, never knew when the change was coming. They kept going, kept going, kept going, and at some point change happened. But they didn't have the crystal ball, right? So then I think that we're motivated by the same recognition. And if you will, if you also, this kind of spiritual peace that comes with that, that we're doing the right thing. And that gives me a lot of peace, gives me a lot of a sense of wholeness, you know, like, and that this is what humanity is supposed to do.
And you talked about kind of connecting as a society to our deeper spiritual roots in the post-GDP world. I wonder, just personally, do you have certain spiritual practices, or how do you connect to your own kind of, you know, essence?
I you know, like, my wife has advised me on many occasions to explore ways of connecting with my inner dimension, if you will, through meditation. I am struggling, but I'm learning. I'm learning as I practice, I'm in a sense, you know, there are times in which, you know, like, just simply being myself, being connected to nature. I love gardening. I love being outside. I love really rethinking my connection with natural systems and with other people. So between playing with my kids, being with my family, and being barefoot in my garden and connecting with the, you know, nature around me, I really find that connection to this, as I said, this idea of wholeness. At the same time, I'm fully aware of the fact that a strong, deep investigation is a precondition for change, but certainly not a sufficient condition. That the science, the type of scientific work I've been doing for the past years, and years of science before I even started, tell me that there is not necessarily a clear connection between internal change, deep transformation, and so deep individual transformation and social transformation. So what we need to do is engage more and more in connecting the internal transformation process, which is a precondition to realize that something is wrong, and the complexity of social transformation. Social transformation is not the sum of individual transformation. Social transformations requires techniques, it requires tools, requires negotiations, requires rules and new systems of systems and patterns of interaction that are often complicated, and that, you know, simply changing ourselves inside will not make us able to change the world. As we have seen in the past before us, internal transformation happened as a precondition to change, but not always succeeded because of the lack of understanding of the fact that good people can still do bad things if they're embedded in a system in which the rules, the expectations, the our understanding of what is appropriate make them behave in the wrong way. Social psychology has given a lot of examples, you know, like good Samaritans that actually did not help people in need just because they're rushing from one talk to the next talk. Every time, I keep saying, you know, if in a sense, every time we catch a plane, we are in a disconnecting ourselves from our internal inner transformation, because, you know, if we're really, really able to connect that with the external environment, we would stop at every traffic light and help people in need, and not accept that just because we have to catch a plane or we have to go to the next talk or there is shopping to be made and so on and so forth, we can't simply overcome the gigantic need for help and change we see every day. So in a sense, that's the real obstacle these days, is to really dive deeper in our own internal consciousness and be able to connect that with external change via a recognition that it's not just the sum of individual transformations, but that social transformations requires a lot of work, painful work, a lot of negotiation, a lot of setting new rules, hence my fixation with GDP.
Mm. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing, Lorenzo. I had a question, sort of taking us back a little bit to the GDP conversation. You know, from my perspective, like, and maybe I'm the choir here, but everything that you shared about how broken GDP is just seems so obvious to me, you know, and I just struggle to see how our decision makers, our folks in power, don't see that. And I understand the context you shared around the usefulness and the utility that measuring GDP created after World War II and then subsequent to that as well. But I'm just curious, and maybe this question is for Preetha as well, I'm curious about whether there has been any credible shift in any of that you've seen in the kind of mainstream halls of power to actually get off GDP as a measure and to have another system be the kind of mainstream measurement, if you will, of how our government tracks progress. Has there been any signs of light, or what do you see as the most hopeful kind of example of that that's most deeply entrenched?
Thank you for that question. You're right, you know, like the strength of GDP is historically given and so on and so forth, but also GDP in a sense has favored a certain Lester model, right? Let me give you this anecdote. In 1994, President Clinton tried to change the way in which GDP was measured in the United States. At the time, Joseph Stiglitz was the chairperson of the Council of Economic Advisors. So they put together a proposal, a mild proposal, to start calculating the costs of environmental impacts and deducting them whenever possible from the calculation of GDP. The U.S. Congress turned it down. And not because they were blind about GDP, but because the coal industry did not want that to happen. Because the coal industry was extremely aware of the fact that if you start measuring the impact of coal on the environment and deducting it from the money that coal is generating, the result is negative. And you know, from living in the United States, how powerful the coal lobby is in the U.S., right? So we have this whole idea that, in a sense, that fossil fuel industries are important for the economy because they generate jobs, because they generate wealth, and they've been part of the economic miracle in America. What if we can finally demonstrate with good accounting that that was just a mirage, that it's never been true, that the coal and the fossil fuel industries have accumulated so much debt that now has to be paid by the American, that has to be, is paid by climate change, is paid by cancer, is paid by diseases, and so on and so forth. If we were able to change that way of accounting for value, these companies would have most likely changed their practices or disappeared altogether and didn't want that to happen. And they don't want that to happen now. So those opposing a lot of work we do on GDP are the big mineral complex and the fossil fuel complex, and those scholars and scientists working for them. So there is this is just one example, but there may be many, many more. And you know, industries have a vested interest in affecting the way in which you measure their success. If you change the measurements, some of them may become, all of a sudden, may go from being profitable and successful to being non-profitable and unsuccessful. And some other industries may actually be seen as marginal and not really relevant, but then you change the way you measure success, and all of a sudden you realize, like, wow, these industries are much more relevant than we think. Let me give another example, if there's time. But, like, think of Google or Facebook, right? I'm not defending Google or Facebook or in any regard, but GDP does a very bad job at measuring the value that Google and Facebook or a lot of online ICT companies generate, for the simple reason that Google, for instance, gives us a lot of services for free. Every time I use a map or use a GPS system provided by Google for free, GDP doesn't grow. Every time I use Skype to call you, and I don't pay a penny to do that Skype call, right? GDP doesn't grow. GDP doesn't like that, in a sense. And these companies, which are extremely big, would be even more, would be seen as even more, as even bigger if we started, for instance, measuring what is the overall impact of having a company providing certain services for free for the sake of people's ability to connect. And more recently, Facebook was assessed. The value of Facebook was assessed to be at $10 a year per user. Now, we all know, I don't use Facebook. I have an account, but I just keep it dormant. But I'm pretty sure that most people who use Facebook wouldn't accept that the value that Facebook brings to them, whether we like it or not, is only $10. You know, of course, you know, like the impact that that has on people's ability to connect, share information, you know, post their own videos, share their videos, create successes, stories, and so on and so forth. It's much more than $10. But the way in which GDP looks at Facebook's value is only in terms of advertising revenues. And that's the only way in which GDP understands the value of Facebook. But we are moving towards generating more and more companies that have ways of creating value which is not monetary. Mozilla. What is the value of Mozilla? For GDP, it's zero because Mozilla is free. But I'm telling you, Mozilla has a huge value for a lot of people that believe in open software. And the same can be said about a lot of other things. What is the value of Wikipedia? For GDP, it's zero. But Wikipedia has a gigantic human and social value, and also economic value, because these days, thanks to Wikipedia, you can share information more quickly, and you can set up a business more quickly, so your transaction costs have been lowered by a service which up until a few years ago was provided at a cost, and nowadays it's provided for free, and this increases your chances of creating a sustainable and dynamic economy. So these are all the things that don't work with GDP. So my hope is that while GDP is supporting certain industries, it's not supporting other industries, and the shift towards a post-GDP system will have some industries opposed, but will have a lot of other industries in favor.
Right. Yeah, and that makes complete sense. I guess there are a couple of other questions in the queue, but I wanted to just add a quick follow-on to see your thoughts on this. I mean, in our current system, you know, you talked about how measurement has, in a way, eroded democracy, and you know, the power of money in our political system is just undeniable, right? I mean, lobbying and just the cost of reaching an office where you have significant power and authority is enormous, and that's all funded by, you know, the system where money really has a very dominant role. So what's the hope in your view of unentrenching that system when, you know, the players are so dominant and the system itself is opposing kind of a recalibration because, you know, it's not in its own self-interest. It's not in the interest of the money that feeds into the system.
It's not easy, I suppose. But we also have to remember that change happened in the past, and systems that were much more resilient and powerful than the systems in which we live collapsed at some point. You know, in 1789, monarchies, you know, collapsed in a matter of weeks, and kings, you know, like were beheaded, and things really changed dramatically. Or in 1776, and so on and so forth. So what I'm trying to say is that change happened in the past, and change mm-hmm. is likely to happen again, and may be very well be it may be happening now. What I'm trying to pursue is a strategy that tries to change the way in which people are understanding value, and the way in which we do that affects, you know, the capacity of lobbies to influence politicians. You know, you can influence politicians if you are embedded in a society in which, you know, a certain understanding of value as profit, as consumption is already ingrained in people. Then on top of that, you use that kind of license to operate, that kind of social license that people give you in order to lobby policymakers to create to make laws that are even more in favor of what you do. But if we can change that social perception, if we can change that social perception to a point that even with money, you can't just go to a policymaker and try to lobby that. We do that already in a sense, you know, like drug cartels, for instance, you know, they have a lot of money, but it's harder for them to lobby policymakers, at least in many democracies, than it is for the fossil fuel industry. But what if we change the public perception of what the fossil fuel industry does, and all of a sudden have a whole, you know, change in that regard, so that people interested in pursuing, you know, like working in the fossil fuel industry or, you know, like making money out of fossil fuels, will see themselves more and more as pariahs, as criminals, as something that society doesn't want to see. Their relative power of influencing decisions will be less and less and less, and this will what I'm trying to say, we'll try to make it, we'll make it more complicated for them to influence decisions. At the same time, the type of economy I'm describing is downscaling. It's scaling things down to the point that even our policy systems will have to change, and it will be much more complicated to infiltrate these policy systems through the power, through the simple power of money, because of more accountability, more localized systems of control, and more peer-to-peer pressure. So, in a sense, I think the type of economy that a shift towards post-GDP, beyond GDP, will create is much less likely to be influenced by strong lobbies, by vested interests, and it's going to be much more transparent, much more accountable, and the social perceptions that will come with a different understanding of value will make a lot of companies we've taken for granted, a lot of systems of production and consumption we have accepted, will make them obsolete and eventually disappear.
Beautiful. I'm going to move to the first question, which I believe is from Michelle Ehlers.
Well, thank you for a fabulous, fabulous conversation. My name is Michelle Ehlers. I'm currently living in San Jose, California, in the United States. And I would just like to acknowledge you for your work and your contribution to humanity. I've lived all over the world. I lived in Zambia as a child. I've lived in China. I've lived in Europe and a number of places, and in the United States. And I have been studying and exploring what I call transformational global leadership, generating fulfillment of a seemingly impossible vision for every human being. And the work that you're doing is very much aligned with that, and would just like to thank you so much for what you're doing. I have a lot of questions for you. I hope we can continue the conversations later, but a couple of things show up right away. One of the things that I've been exploring is how do you stay very centered in your personal practice and your personal engagement, like gardening, which I also find very, very fulfilling and very focused on how I can personally contribute, at the same time in a local engagement, but also connect to what's happening globally. A lot of the things that we need to be looking at are systems at the global level. And if we're decentralizing some of what we're doing, how do we also provide leadership training or studying or awareness of what's happening globally so people who are engaging locally also are very tapped in, not only socially, but also in terms of what is happening globally in the systems domain so that we can be generating local, whatever we're deciding to do locally is also informed by what's happening globally. That, to me, is a really big challenge. The other thing is, if we're looking at what we're doing globally, how do we measure the global shift? Do we need something like a global, something to measure the global progress, not just national progress? How do we develop that so we start thinking in terms of what's happening overall for humanity, not just nationally?
Thanks, Michelle, for that question. It is hard. I agree with you. The whole local global connection is very hard, and how to keep a balance, how to keep the equilibrium in personal and structural is very complicated. I think it's really a matter of learning by doing, and I think I'm far from having learned, the secret of how you keep that going. I think having a family, having kids that I'm very close to, makes me more grounded and makes me able to say often that, for instance, I travel much less than I used to, and I have new strategies whereby when I give talks, I usually travel in one go and take the family with. People have to accept the fact that when I'm giving a talk, my kids will run around. And just a couple of times it happened that some of them were screaming while I was talking to 1,000 people. And that's the way it is. And I think what I'm seeing is that more and more people love that. More and more people love the fact that this is not an intellectual effort, that there's more humanity behind it. There's more kindness behind it. It's a real life, it's a real life story, it's something that involves people with real and real lives, real responsibilities, just people like all of us. And at the same time, you know, what I'm trying to do, what the people I work with are doing, is connecting as much as possible via the internet. So we continuously do things like we're doing tonight, you know, connecting over the phone, connecting with conference calls, connecting across the globe, being continuously in this kind of global community of like-minded intellectuals, like-minded scholars, like-minded activists. They're trying to organize. This is really important. The system that we're trying to defeat was developed over time through strong and significant organization. It just didn't happen by miracle, or it just didn't fall on to us because of the divine intervention. It was crafted step after step by people that worked together. In order to defeat and, you know, like, and change this, we have to be as organized and as structured. And I think that requires a lot of continuous conversations. And nowadays, thank God, we do have technologies that allow us to do that. And, you know, writing books, and giving talks, and sharing information, sharing papers, sharing everything, you know, supporting campaigns. We do Avaaz calls for signatories and online petitions and so on and so forth. We're trying to do everything we can in order to keep the momentum going and not letting this window of opportunity, which is open, simply go, or being hijacked by somebody with a different agenda. And I think, in a sense, this is about reactivating our democratic systems. What you're saying about the global level and not just the national level, I would take it to the next level. What about abandoning the national level to begin with, you know, completely, and reconnecting ourselves to a system, a global system, which is just a network of local units, and connecting, the, you know, creating even measurements. I mean, my dream for a post-GDP world is not GDP being replaced by a better big number. It's about each and every community deciding what to measure because of their values and their aspirations, and walking towards that objective. We don't have to have a standard measure in which we're all measured in the same way. Just like, you know, our understanding of beauty, of pleasure, of happiness, we cannot put it on a scale. We cannot say who's more beautiful than somebody, who was more beautiful, was more happy, was more pleasant, and so on and so forth. We have to accept the fact that a strong society in which people participate and generate well-being through their interactions that are in close touch with themselves, with each other, and with nature, has to be given a chance to measure, to define the objectives that they want to pursue and measure them according to their own preferences. And this is going to create diversity, but it's also going to create a lot of beauty, a lot of dialogue, a lot of capacity of interaction across these communities. We have to move. So in a sense, my fight against GDP is a fight for true democracy. It's a fight for people being able to finally decide what are the ultimate objectives of their governance systems and able to measure them accordingly and pursue them in freedom. So in the national perspective, this whole obsession with, you know, comparing apples and oranges, you know, who's more beautiful, who's less beautiful, who's more developed, who's less developed, has done us a lot of damage. It's really impaired our capacity to be creative, and we can change that. We can change that if we're serious about this, you know, this process of moving beyond GDP, not just by putting a better number there, but by rethinking the role of numbers to begin with. And I think in my books, How Numbers Rule the World, you find really this critique. You find this critique that numbers have become one of the main obstacles to true democracy. It's not just the influence of money or lobbies or big powers or corporations. It's our acceptance of numbers as the only way of generating order and generating a society which has certain rules, but at the same time we have lost our capacity to influence those rules.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll move on to the next question.
Thank you, Rahul. Hi, Lorenzo. I'm Devin, and
hi.
I'm calling from Orange, California. When you said, Lorenzo, when you mentioned that the fossil fuels and the outcomes and the chain of events it has created is a debt that we are paying in terms of fighting cancers and range of side effects, it's so thought-provoking, actually. And the part that excited me so much from your conversation is the movement happening. This is like we are up against very big companies and established lobby and all that you explained. I like the movement part, and that excited me. Would you share with us a few resources, maybe after the call or right now, where we can learn more about this, shall I say, alternative economic model? So I'd love to know more about it. It's fascinating, very insightful. Thank you for the call. And any other links, any other information that you might be able to share, would really appreciate.
Thanks for that question. I think, you know, like there's a lot of studies that are being done around the world of healthcare impacts of a certain development, you know, certain policies like development model, like the GDP-based one. You can read the Global Burden of Disease studies that basically associate the type, you know, the amount of people who die and the healthcare costs of certain types of industrialization models, and can help you understand, you know, like the extent to which, for instance, pollution is costing China billions and billions and billions of dollars every month. Money that is not being accounted for, but money that is real because people are dying and getting sick. And the same, you know, there's a company called TrueCost, which has an online, a beautiful online website, and a lot of free reports you can read. And what they do, their job is to go and screen companies, not instead of in terms of profit, which is what usually, you know, Standard & Poor's and the credit rating agencies do, right? They usually just look at profits and then tell you this is a good investment, that's a bad investment, right? And you follow the rating agencies, when not you and me, but, you know, like people, investors follow those reports by Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Fitch ratings to decide where to put their money. And all they do is to look at more or less the amount of money that these companies make. TrueCost does something different. It looks at the whole value chain of a company and tries to measure what are the environmental impacts, what are the health impacts, and what are the social impacts, and to certain, and then gives you an idea, a picture of a company, not just in terms of the money it makes, but actually the overall impact of that company. And some of these many companies that we believe are successful, when measured according to the overall impact, become extremely, extremely bad. So in a sense, there is a lot of, if you're interested in reading more, you can just look at some of these resources, and that can, you know, that can kind of can kind of help you do that. And in a sense, what I'd like to add is, it's fine to talk about companies and some corporations as being part of the problem, because we all know that, and especially in the U.S., the power of certain lobbies and big corporations is so gigantic that it's hard to deny that. But ultimately, corporations are made out of people, right? And some of these people have got, you know, just let me paraphrase Sting, but, you know, corporates have got children too, right? So they are people, right? So, and we have to start seeing these people as also embedded in a system of rules that makes them behave like Nazis, makes them behave like bad people. But often they're not bad people themselves, but the rules in which they're operating, the systems that they have created, the expectations they have generated, and what is considered appropriate in some of these companies makes good people act like bad people. And that's why we need to change that as well. If we start changing the way in which we measure success of a company, we give a powerful weapon to one of these business people that want to change, those that want to change their own companies. They can go back to their managers and CEO and say, here it is. I've been trying to tell you this for so long. We're not successful. We're destroying things. We have to change. So we're not just fighting against the corporate world. We're even helping those in the corporate world change. Those who want to change are looking for some of these inputs and some of these ideas to be able to wave a different flag and try to take over the corporate world to turn it into something, into force for good, rather than in a force for bad as it is at the moment.
Thank you. And you mentioned TrueCost, right? That's the organization,
yes,
that you mentioned, TrueCost.
TrueCost.
Got it. Okay. Thank you so much, Lorenzo. Thank you. Thank you, Rahul.
I actually had another question, Lorenzo, that was related to this concept that you were sharing and that Devin touched on these corporations that are actually net, really costs on the system, true costs, I suppose. I wonder if you have come across any data that has looked at the system of industrial meat production. You know, as I think about things like coal, which obviously has a powerful lobby and
produces net harm, it's hard for me to wrap my head around something that could produce more harm than maybe the system of industrial meat production. Do you know of any resources or studies that have been done around this and what the sort of conclusions have been?
Well, when you start looking at, you know, different types of industries and with an open eye and trying to really, you know, come to terms with the reality that what GDP tells you is very myopic, as I said, it's a very partial, very misleading story, then you start seeing different things. You know, like, as I said, it's like to be, like the best metaphor is really you cut through the matrix and you start seeing reality for what it is. And you get a sense that, you know, like there's, you know, most of the companies we're looking at, in a sense, you know, like not just the fossil fuel industry, but also the large corporations, the large distribution systems, Walmart, you name it, you know, like all these gigantic companies are fundamentally inefficient, and fundamentally their net harm is more than their net profit, and so, or even their tax base. So there's no reason to justify their existence. And unless they change, they should be shut down, basically, or, you know, they should be accompanied towards a meaningful transformation and transition. So what I'm trying to say is that the shift towards a post-GDP economy is inevitably a shift towards another type of industrialization and another type of company, another type of business model. And this business model will be, by and large, similar to what I described at the beginning, you know, like completely rethinking what business is for and reembedding the economy into society, in which there is no clear distinction between who's the economy and who's inside the economy and who's outside. That's another mystification of our current model, right? That we believe there's something called the economy, and we enter the economy, we leave the economy, somebody's part of the economy, somebody's not part of the economy. The economy doesn't exist. It's just a system of rules within a society. And we need to transform that so as to be able to reconnect the economy to society. And we all become part of the economy whenever we do anything that creates well-being, that generates opportunities for one another, whether we're exchanging it for money or not. That's the only type of economy that can survive a serious well-being orientation of a post-GDP shift. So, in a sense, as I said, you know, like it's really not just about, you know, tweaking and changing the type of company you have, but it's about embarking together on a much more ambitious process, which is the one of reimagining the role of business and the role of business activities in a modern society. And I think that's why I think I'm very excited about this. It's totally not mundane. It's totally not trite, or it's not the dry numbers of economic accounting. It's more about using that as a Trojan horse to be able to change fundamentally not just our model of industrialization, but our deep structure of economic interaction.
Thank you, Lorenzo. This has been such an amazing conversation, and I wanted to just close a little bit with, you know, where your final remarks were headed a little bit, where when you were talking about that it's not just a series of internal transformations that leads to kind of broad-scale social change, but, you know, also, you know, some negotiation and kind of altering the rules. And I wanted to just come back to that because, you know, it's something I've spent a lot of my life trying to think about and do and how best to bring about social change. And the question I guess I have is, how do you create, it's not all internal, obviously, and there is a need for external action, but how does the consciousness shift happen whereby people are open to that renegotiation of rules, if not through the internal transformation processes?
That's a very good question, and probably the answer is that I don't really know. I think, you know, I believe that at times, you know, like being touched, being exposed to moments of truth, you know, moments of generosity, moments of reciprocity. I also think, you know, being shown that you know, being challenged in our convictions that things are the way they are by seeing that. You know, by seeing people and groups that behave differently, or even just individuals that behave differently, can help us see through this veil of of mystification which has been created by the type of economy or type of society in which we're living. That is, to me, a trigger that can move, open a window on your deeper dive into your consciousness. And also I think that even people who are not and honest with themselves, they deep down they know there's something wrong. So in a sense, what we have to do is simply reduce the chances that these people have to just fool themselves, right? The entire system, the entire economy, the entire society works with rules that help you fool yourself. Every time you don't stop when somebody's in need on the street, you're fooling yourself. Usually there is a rational process called the bystander effect. You know, you just see something happening and thinking, oh, I have to go to work. Look, you know, I'd like to help, but somebody will help. Don't worry. So the ambulance will come, or somebody else that doesn't have, is not in a hurry as much as I am, will stop and do something. So we are rationally fooling ourselves, right? And I think a lot of people do this on a daily basis. The fewer opportunities people have to do so, because they engage in conversations, because they exchange views with people that are practicing a different way of doing things, the more they do this, the fewer opportunities these people have to fool themselves, the more they're going to come to terms with their inner transform kind of the inner consciousness, and the more they were going to be ready to embark on a journey. So it is really about lowering, you know, the continuous. This is a powerful force in society, a powerful force that makes good people do bad things. And it's not because these good people do not have a sense of what they are and not in touch with themselves, with their inner souls, but it's also because there are these systems out there help you fool yourself all the time. So the more we challenge those systems, the more we create opportunities for generosity, for exchanges that defy the assumption that all we do is for self-interest, that all we do is for money, that all we do is for an economic return. The more we do this, the more we lower reduce the amount of fooling that goes into talking to oneself, opening up opportunities for reflection, and then allowing these people to connect to the bigger social transformation.
Wow, thank you so much, Lorenzo. One last question for me, and I know we're about a minute over, but we always like to ask all of our guests how we as the broader service space community can do something to support you or your work. What is it that we can do to be of service to you?
Well, I think you're a great example of what I just said. I think, you know, having known Nipun for some time and getting to know you guys better, I believe you guys are a great example of doing things for a different purpose and defying categorizations, defying expectations, and kind of, you know, cutting through the fog of mystification that comes out of the rules that I've just described. So you're doing a lot of, just by because you exist, you're helping people like me to try to do the type of work that I do. More practically, I think to me, we stand a great opportunity to really kind of organize and group our energies to change one thing in how we organize our societies, and then have a cascade snowball effect, right? So often we talk about, you know, for decades people have been talking about, you know, defying capitalism, or, you know, defying imperialism, or, you know, the environmentalists were trying to save the environment, but those interested in social rights were interested in improving the condition of the workers and so on and so forth. It was divided groups that were operating in silos, and none of them really succeeding. Now I believe now we stand a chance to fight one single thing that can open a totally different opportunity to redesign our economies and societies. If we kind of group together and kind of discuss the fact that all our different goals in society, whether we're an environmentalist, whether we are a pacifist, whether you are a human rights activist, and so on and so forth, what you have in common is that all these worthy causes have been neglected because our economy and our societies have been given a different purpose, have been given a different objective. If we change that objective, guess what? All the good things we wanted to create are more likely to become mainstream, something that people see as creating value for society rather than taking away resources, than distracting us. You know, like all the good things, all the important things we can do together in a society which is no longer obsessed with GDP growth, but a society which wants to pursue something different, all those good things are going to become much more prominent and part of the core of policymaking and decision-making, not just a marginal residual thing that you have to do because there is a moral, ethical imperative at some point. So what I'm asking you, in a sense, is try to share this idea, that share this vision that fighting together against GDP growth is probably the most significant battle we can do to pursue and achieve all the different objectives we have given ourselves in life, that there is a common cause we can all fight against, and STANS gives us a great opportunity to have this gigantic positive cascade effect throughout society that all of a sudden will open up opportunities that were that are unprecedented.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for that, for those insights and wisdom. We'd like to end the call with a minute of silence, after which I will unmute everyone and we'll have an opportunity to kind of share some collective gratitude. I have unmuted everyone on the call, and what we'll have the chance to do now at the count of three is to just kind of shout out our thank yous to Lorenzo for dialing in from South Africa despite the little bit of technical difficulties and being gracious enough to spend a few extra minutes with us as he answered those last-minute questions. So, on the count of three, we'll just say thank you, Lorenzo. One, two, three. Thank you, Lorenzo.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.